I've talked to a number of people, and I ran an article about 3 months ago, and I want to do another one, and I wanted to touch base with you. My first question is, talk to me about, you worked only with tape. I mean, you came in to recording after tape had arrived after World War II.
No, that's not true.
That's not true.
Where are you from?
I'm actually originally from Atlanta, but I'm calling you from Pennsylvania, where I live now.
Oh, what part?
York.
Oh, that's nice, yeah.
Yeah, it is nice.
I'm a big Civil War fan.
Well,
so I know the Gettysburg area.
That's right. We're just, as you know, east of Gettysburg.
Right, right. You're lucky the South didn't win you. They would have been going through York to Washington.
That's right. That was the place. It would have happened.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I started when they had the big 16-inch transcription disc.
Okay. So before you started before the war, then?
No.
Or after the war, but before you got tape?
Yeah, well, they didn't use tape that quick after the war.
Okay.
At least I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, could you define what your philosophy of production was? What was the goal for you, the role of a producer?
Well, do you know that I used to own Prestige?
Yes, yes.
Well, I started with a company called New Jazz. That was my original name, New Jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a jazz fan. I started when I was 8 years old, collecting records. My father took me to a record store where they had a sale on for 9 cents. Record 78s, and he picked out records by Ellington, Fletcher Henderson, Benny Goodman, Woody Herman, Count Basie, and he got me interested. That's, I started like that, and then I went into small groups, Coleman Hawkins, Roy Aldridge, Louis Armstrong, you know, and actually Louis, I liked him, was Hot 5 and Hot 7. I went listened to him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I just went on and on from that. And I had a mail order business after World War II for collector's items. That was very successful. People used to come to my house, and on a Saturday, the house was overrun. So I leased space in a record store that sold used records, and I opened half the store for whole collector's items. New records. Well, I stopped selling the old records because the owner of the store, he sold the old records. But I started selling new records. And I sold thousands of the Charlie Parker dials and Savoys. And on the other hand, I sold thousands of reissues of Louis Armstrong, Bessie Smith, King Oliver. My clientele, that old saying, everything from bunk to monk. I went from New Orleans right up to monk. And how I got into bebop was Alfred Lion of Blue Note. I used to buy hundreds and hundreds of his Sidney Bechet records on the Blue Note label. And he had George Lewis New Orleans music on his Climax label, 12-inch records, 78s. And he brought me a Thelonious Monk once as a present to listen to this. And I did, and I got interested in bebop. And I used to sell a bebop, but I didn't care for it. But when I heard Monk, and when someone like Alfred Lion, who I respected for recording the old jazz, got into Monk, it really opened my eyes up.
Yeah.
Because Alfred, to this day, has been my idol. His Blue Note records were really great, you know.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I started to like that, and then musicians like Kenny Clark took me to the Royal Roost because he'd come to my store, Alan Eager, Lee Konitz, Kenny Dorham, they used to come to my store and I got to know the musicians, and Kenny Clark especially took me down to the Roost and introduced me to Tad Dameron, Thelonious Monk, Pat Navarro, Dexter Gordon, Wardell Gray, Bud Powell, Max Roach, and so on, and they all saw that I loved jazz, which I did. Jazz was my life. I loved jazz. And all my waking moments were involved with jazz. In my store, I was always playing jazz in the store for the people, and they'd hear it outside. That's how come the musicians came. on the way to work at Birdland, they'd hear the music and come look where it was coming from. So anyway, they even gave me the promotion director, Monty Kay, of the Royal Roos. It wasn't Birdland. If I said Birdland, it's wrong. It was the Royal Roos originally. He gave me a free pass to go in there because I was such a fan.
Oh, yeah.
And the musicians loved me because they knew I was sincere about their music. And sometimes on a Saturday night, there'd be lines out to the street. I just walked down the stairs, flashed my pass, and I was in, you know. So that's when I started the company. And I would have loved to record a Dizzy Gillespie and Bird because they were, to me, were the greatest at the time. You know, the pioneers of bebop and the best in bebop. But unfortunately, they were tied up, and I couldn't get them, so... Being a jazz fan, I went one step further to Lee Konitz, who referred me to his mentor and his maestro, say, Lenny Tristano. And Lee said, look, I'd like to record. I've never recorded. I recorded with Claude Thornhill in a big band. But it would be better for everybody if Lenny Tristano would be the leader. He has more name power. And I feel more secure doing my first recording with Lenny as the leader.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. And it was a smash hit, you know, in the jazz circles. All the critics gave it 5 stars, and stores all over the United States would call up and order it. You know, it was like swamped with orders.
Yeah.
And they even sent their checks for the record to get it quick. They said, here, we're enclosing so-and-so, send me the records at once. So anyway, it was a smash hit, and that was the pattern of the company for the time being. New jazz, you know. I was forced into it, not having Bird and Dizzy to use, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, I did Terry Gibbs with Shorty Rogers, George Washington, Stan Getz next, and that's how I met Getz. And Getz was my first big seller. We did all these pretty songs with Stan Getz, and the record sold tremendous. Stations that never played jazz would play Stan Getz as My Old Flame, There's a Small Hotel, and stuff like that. And the company was very successful due to Stan, and then I got Miles and Sonny Rollins and James Moody, Sonny Stitt, and I had a big smash hit. James Moody, I'm in the Mood for Love, which was a continuation of that melodic Stan Getz stuff, and it was a monster, and King Pleasure put words to it called Moody's Mood for Love. That was a big monster hit to King Pleasure, so the company was sort of put on the map with these early successes.
Yeah.
But I never, you know, I did venture into more commercial music with funky stuff with Gene Ammons, Sonny Stitt, Moody, Wardell Gray, and so on. But right up to the end when I sold the company, we never abandoned jazz.
Right.
You know, I always did real modern jazz like Miles, Rollins, you know, Coltrane.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, we did a lot of things like Booker Irvin, Jackie Byard, Mal Waldron, Eric Dolphy, newer things, you know.
Yeah.
Cedar Walton did stuff. If you look through the discography, you'll see up until the time I sold the company, we were really going ahead really fast back into real jazz, uncommercial jazz. We had a lot of commercial jazz.
Yeah.
Gene Ammons was a monster seller for me all these years. Etta Jones sold very big. But when a company makes a lot of money, like my philosophy was, I had two choices. But I always did good. That's a little drop here and there. But basically, I always did good, and I always come up with hits like Groove Home and Misty, Eddie Jones Don't Go to Strangers, Charlie Irwin's More Today Than Yesterday, Gene Ammons' Canadian Sunset, and so on. And when these hits came, the money would pour in because we weren't geared to produce hits, so our expenses were geared for jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And we had small expenses and budget. I owned my own building and so on. So I had two choices at that point. One, I could pay the government taxes, or two, I structured my business that all recording salaries were an expense. And once I made that option, I remained consistent. It was okay with the IRS. That any monies we spent for recording salaries was a deduction.
Yeah.
So I did labels. I revived new jazz with a lot of new people. I had moved through with all great players playing beautiful slow music, and the swing label with big name swing stars like Coleman Hawkins, Pee Wee Russell, you know, Bud Freeman.
Yeah.
So I was having a ball, and the government was really like subsidizing it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, I made a good salary. I would live like a king, and I was having fun.
Yeah.
You know, producing all those great jazz.
Yeah.
And right up to the end, you know, we were doing that. We started a historical series with Don Schlitten, who was a owned Xanadu label after I sold my company. And you should interview him, by the way.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you know where he lives now?
He lives in Pelham, New York. Before we're gone, I'll give you his friend's number.
Okay.
Schlitten is a very good guy to interview. He's like me. He was a real jazz fan.
Yeah.
No bullshit.
Yeah.
And he loves jazz, and he suffers for jazz, and he's been a collector, like, as long as I have. And anyway, so Don was doing a historical series. You were getting all kinds of great old things. And then, unfortunately, the business went bad, where the wholesalers were going bankrupt left and right. And it became a problem where to sell records. There were
yeah.
no more wholesalers. Because the major companies opened up their own distribution. Atlantic, which was a big independent and kept wholesalers in business for years and years, they could live on Atlantic plus other independents. They went to Time Warner, and that was the end of these small distributors. They weren't really small. They were big independents.
Mm-hmm.
But consequently, that hurt me, you know. They would go out of business when they lost Atlantic.
Yeah.
So that's why I just said, the hell with this. It wasn't fun anymore when you could make records and not be able to sell them, or even if you could sell them, you could never get paid anymore.
Yeah.
So Fantasy gave me a very fair offer, and, you know, they met my price and my whatever I wanted, they gave me, and they treated me very fairly, you know, because I knew Ralph Kaffel. He was my distributor in Los Angeles many years before he got involved with Fantasy, was instrumental in having the sale made. But I knew him, and he was very nice to me. And Saul Zance, who was the head of Fantasy at the time, he was very honorable. I mean, I couldn't ask for better treatment. And then I asked Ralph quite a few times through the years when the CDs came, what about doing some things? And he said, no. CDs are too expensive to produce new ones. He says, we got thousands and thousands of great jazz things from all our labels, you know, Riverside, Contemporary, Prestige, Pablo.
Yeah.
We got so much great stuff we got to put out. And new things just don't sell that good, and we lose a fortune. And they tried with, you know, doing some new things with Lauren Keith News at one point, and that didn't work out. So he just said, no, Bob, I can't, honest. And Ralph would never lie to me. We're too good. We're friends for too
yeah.
many years. He always said the truth. And he said, it's just not feasible. The cost of producing the CDs, you know, back when they started, were so high. He said, add to that production cost for new material, and we'd never come out, you know.
Yeah.
He said, even put out reissues, it cost too much, a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, after a while, I finally approached him, and I did this Billy Ross session, his tribute to Stan Getz, The Sound, and, you know, Billy was very insistent on having me produce it. You know, he knew all about me, had many of my records, because Billy, for a jazz musician, he's like a jazz fan, actually, and he said, man, I want you to produce it. You know, I'll pay for it. I don't care. You know, I do well. I just want you to produce the CD because this is my dream, to do a tribute to Stan Getz, my mentor, you know,
yeah.
my idol. So I said, all right, Billy, I'm going to do it with you, you know, because he was so insistent and sincere. And I liked him because he knew everything about jazz, you know.
Yeah.
He knew about Don Byers, Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, Lester Young, Zoo. You know, anyway, Gene Ammons, you name it, Billy knows all about it, and he has his own style, but he knows about everything, but including the modern players like Train and Rollins and so on.
Yeah.
So he was such a sincere person, so I'm going to help this guy, you know? And I said, all right, we'll do it. Being, you know, you want to do it, we'll do it. So finally I called Ralph back because he said he didn't want it before. He said, I don't want any new stuff, he says. He says, look, Ralph, I call him up almost like a mafia-type call because, you know, I get, I'm like a hockey player. I never quit, man, you know.
Yeah.
I love hockey, and I never quit. And if I'm losing, my team's losing 7-0, and the guy does something I don't like, I'm going to smack him into the boards and hit him. And so I went back, right back at Ralph, and I said, look, Ralph, we're doing this. Billy's going to do it, and I want to do it, and I don't want to go to any other record company. You're my friend. I know you for years. I want it done for you. And that's it. And here's the deal. Give Billy so much. I'm not going to take any money. You'll give me royalty. Give me so much. And that's it. We're going to do it.
Yeah.
So he says, okay. And I meant it. I was the only call I made. I could have called other companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have got a lot of money, you know, to do these projects. But I didn't want to do it.
Because
I want to do it because I want to do it, not because I'm under contract. I don't want to do it because I'm working for a corporation to impress people. I want to do it for a person that's sincere, that understands what I'm doing, that supports them. I don't want no pressure doing it. And I want to suggest things, not to be turned down, but to be supported when I say I want to do something.
Yeah.
And Ralph has just given me very slight guidelines. My guidelines, I'll say, very simple. To put it in the article. One, he doesn't want artists that are overproduced on CD. You know, not too many CDs.
Right.
Two, he wants to keep up my image through the years and sort of the company that, you know, the companies he's had. He wants it to be modern jazz. Okay? And three, he doesn't want, you know, over commercial. He wants it something that this jockey would like to play, but not a deliberate attempt at commercialism. So in other words, he wants to go over again. Artists that are not overproduced, two, artists that are modern, and artists that have something to please the disc jockeys.
Yeah.
And critics. Why? The last thing, why? Fantasy has a tremendous mailing list of disc jockeys and reviewers. They send out more records free than the average small company, and there's tons of small companies in the last few years with the CDs. I know the figures because the artists tell me how many they sell, how many they make, and they send out more free, probably 2 and 3 times the amount that most companies sell.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
And he says, we have to promote. You know, so many companies, so many artists, so many releases, we have to promote. So that's all my requirement is that I think about it, I just don't record. Joe Blow and the All Stars. You know, I have to use my head and come up with something that's got a little, you know, something that a DJ will say, that's interesting. You
right.
know, this is a little different.
Yeah.
And that's my only guidelines. And then he gave me a schedule of 4 CDs the first year, which I've done. I just finished my 4. And the fourth ones, I had Billy Ross first, Duffy Jackson second, who was sort of mostly big band. My third one just came out as Gary Campbell. Was a tremendous jazz artist, but it's a sort of a mixture of Latin and straight-ahead American jazz.
Yeah.
And then my fourth one is Turk Morrow, who's playing in Europe with Buddy Rich here and Dizzy. And he's very well liked all over, especially in South Florida and New York. We did a tribute to Gene Ammons because Gene was with me 20 years or more. I felt I would like to do it. I wanted to do a tribute for Gene. And we did all his famous songs. And it's called Hitting the Jug. That's his nickname, Jug.
Yeah.
And we had a wonderful rhythm section of Lonnie Smith on piano and organ. A new star, Jeff Grubbs, who's a phenomenal bass player with the symphony, Miami Symphony, I think Miami Orchestra, but he's a great jazz player, and Duffy Jackson on drums, and that rhythm section, man, swung.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Kirk really played beautiful. That finished my first year's recording. And now we started the second year, I'm going to be doing eight, double. Because Ralph's happy and I enjoy it, you know, and I'm happy, so everything's going. Our first one launching the second year is a big band with Melton Mustafa, who played, he was Basie for 8 years arranging and playing trumpet. And he had a great band that I heard at the Hollywood Jazz Festival last summer. And I just heard the band one time, and as soon as I got an increase in my recording, I asked him to do a CD.
Oh, yeah.
Really great band. It really impressed me. And then we have a few other things coming, you know, after that.
I saw Duffy Jackson, actually. I used to live in Tampa. I saw Duffy Jackson in Tampa when he was with the Basie band.
Right.
Basie played at the Tampa Theater, and Duffy Jackson was a drummer.
Right.
Yeah, that was a great show.
Yeah, well, he's playing down here every week on Sunday afternoons.
Oh, yeah. When you talk about early on your big hits, you place many of those copies with companies that stock jukeboxes, too. That was a big market at that time,
yeah, well,
right?
Oh, yeah, well, to have a hit, right, you're right, absolutely. See, originally the company had 78s. That was our original releases, were on 78 RPM. And then eventually we got into 45s. So after 78s exited from jukeboxes, then you had to have 45s. The boxes only would have 45s. And you're right, that's what made a hit. If you had a record go on the jukeboxes, it meant more exposure to people. And it was a vicious cycle. If it was on the boxes, it would get reported in cash box and stuff, and then the disc jockeys would pick up jockeys that played beyond jazz.
Yeah.
You know, R&B, a lot of the R&B black disc jockeys would play Gene Ammons and stuff like that.
Right.
And a lot of the pop stations, you know, like you have these pop stations now, they call it adult contemporary, they pick up on a Stan Getz and play it, you know, right after Sinatra or Steve Lawrence, they play Getz's Small Hotel or something.
Now, did the Mafia and, you know, Wise Guys really own jukeboxes? Did they control that market, or is that a myth?
That's a myth. They had bigger places to make money.
Yeah.
Yeah, small local guys, yeah. But the jukebox industry wasn't big enough for them.
Okay.
No, you know, that's a myth.
One of the things you're famous for is certainly you never told artists, here's what we're going to do. You didn't tell them what to do and plot their sessions for them. How did you shape a session?
Well, basically, I could tell you back then or now.
Give me an example of, let's say, Saxophone Colossus.
Saxophone Colossus.
Yeah.
Well, basically, what I would do, do you remember, I think, was that Tommy Flanagan?
Sonny Rollins, Tommy Flanagan, and...
Who was the bass and drum?
Oh, God, I'm trying... Well, I'm trying to remember whether Kenny Clarke was in. No, he was in Europe by that time.
Right.
Boy.
Well, anyway, see, I could go look it up, but
yeah.
I got my discography. Do you remember what year?
I'm not. I could.
Well,
I could
don't
actually
have to
look
be
it
that
up
specific.
Too. Yeah, I think it's 1957.
All right. Basically, once we got into the LP era, right?
Right.
Okay. Before the LP era, you were bound by 3.5 minute 78s the most, right? And then I sensed that we're going to have LPs. You know, I just heard rumblings.
Yeah.
And I did three sessions that were very monumental. The first one was Miles Davis with Sonny Rollins, Jackie McQueen, Art Blakey was on drums, and you can look up the rest of these names.
Okay, yeah, I'll plug them in. Yeah,
you describe it. You got a discovery, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Okay, so I think it may have been Walter Bishop, Percy Heath, but I'm not sure. But anyway, I just said, Miles, we're going to stretch out. So he says, you mean, you know, we're just going to play? I said, as long as you want, almost, you know? within reason. So he said, okay, who should I use? So I said, right, well, you seem to love Sonny Rollins. You know, if you look at the early ones, Sonny's on a lot of miles.
Yeah.
I said, you love Sonny. And he says, well, what about this young guy, Jackie McLean? He's pretty good, too, if we're going to stretch out. I said, yeah, I heard him. He's good. So if you listen, we did Dig, that session, Dig, Blueing. Now, Jackie don't play on all the tunes because he wasn't really that great at that time. He was good. So Miles and Sonny stretched out, right? So that's how it sort of went. We'd always talk about the personnel, what we're going to do. A lot of times they'd have tunes, other times I'd have tunes. And our main emphasis was just to play and stretch out. And we accomplished that there. The next one I did, I don't remember when, a zoo.
I remember the personnel on Saxophone Colossus now. It's Max Roach, I believe, on drums.
Yeah. Right.
And it's Doug Watkins on bass.
All right, well, I'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so the next thing that happened, I either did Zoot Sims with a quartet next or Jerry Mulligan's Tentet next. One of those two were first. So on the Jerry thing, I had him stretch out Mulligan's two and all of that. And he played a long solo, and he knew that we're going to do the Tentet or whatever the group was, and then him and Eager would play, you know, after, stretch out.
Yeah.
So they did that, and they'd sort of look at me if I wanted to play more, and I'd shake my head, yeah, no, whatever. Then they'd switch. I'd say, you know, I sort of cut my throat, and then he'd know he'd be going out at the end of the chorus. And then Zoot, one of the best Zoot Sims albums ever made, I think, and I love Zoot. He's one of my all-time favorites, not only as a musician, as a person. It's called Zoot Swings the Blues, where he just been going on and on and on and on. And do you ever hear those?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how I said, Zoot, we're going to stretch out, you know? So I don't know, he did some shorter track, but they knew, and we spoke about it, and that's what we agreed on. You know, it was like mutual.
Yeah.
You know, they had to be up to it, because if a guy didn't have confidence in himself, he couldn't do what Zoot did and Jerry and Miles and those guys, you know. And then a lot of times I kept it always loose, you know, that we'd have a basic framework, who we're going to use, we'd discuss it. I didn't try and shove people down their throat. They didn't try and shove them down my throat. And same with the material. I'd have suggestions. They'd have suggestions. But it was sort of in the studio. I was like Al Haig and Red Garland and Coltrane and Getz. My knowledge of songs was tremendous, like those four people I just mentioned.
Yeah.
That if we were hung, I'd say, well, let's play 8-Train, you know, Russian Lullaby? Sure, man. You know, boom, Russian Lullaby, just like that. And he could teach it to everybody on the session.
Okay.
And it was all very loose. I hated charts. I hated arrangements. And that's where me and Alfred differed. Alfred would have rehearsals. I never had a rehearsal. I didn't believe in it. I believed jazz had a swing and be loose. But, you know, it was something that it had to be mutual, because you can't tell these giants, they were greats, man, what to do. They're not flunkies. A lot of companies today, they got young kids doing the recording, trying to tell these people what to do.
Yeah.
And these aren't even giants like they used to be, you know?
Right.
But when you get to Colossus, there were certain things, like the Miles Monk and session, the Miles Monk Milt Jackson session, the Miles J.J. Lucky Thompson Horace Silver session, Walking, Bag's Groove was the first one I mentioned, and the Colossus. You know, Sonny came in with this group. This is what we wanted to record. We agreed, you know. Fine, great. Max Roach, sure, anytime. Flanagan, anytime, you know. But once he was there, this is like a ball game, man. The team's either hot or cold. You know, like, you see sometimes a football team in the last minute, Dan Marino is a master. He'll march down the field, like, for two touchdowns in 2 minutes. So that's what, you're in there, it's like a big ball game, you know. That's
yeah.
The way I played it. I was in the middle of the Stanley Cup seventh game, and with Mario Lemieux playing against Wayne Gretzky, you know.
Yeah.
And when you get a saxophone Colossus and you hear this blue seven, man, just hearing building and building. And I just go over there. I sit out in the studio. I left Rudy Van Gelder alone all the time. I didn't go near Rudy Van Gelder. I never told, you know, in the 54 we started, 18 years, maybe 18 years, I never told Rudy Van Gelder anything about recording. The man was a genius, you know? So I'd be out there with the musicians. And if I saw Sonny Rollins was playing his ass off, like a Blue 7, which to me is a classic.
Oh, yeah.
I'd just give him the sign, like, you know, you wind your fingers around in a circle. I mean, kept going.
Right.
Other times I show him the stopwatch, and I throw it into the couch, and that meant time's no more time. Play, man. I did that to Lucky Thompson. He played more, twice as much as Miles, I think, on Miles' session. He was so great on walking, I showed him the stopwatch, and I threw it in the couch. And he just nodded, closed his eyes, and kept playing and playing, you know. See, that's what, to me, we were in a game. It was a hockey game, a pro football game. This was not all planned, you know, spontaneous, all of this shit. I've had bands like the great Gil Evans, who was a monster arranger, one of the best in the history of jazz. He came and did a session, and it just wasn't happening, his charts, you know?
Yeah.
And Lee Konitz there, good people. I said, I took him over to the side. I said, Gil, this is nothing happening. I don't know why, man, you know? Beautiful music. He says, I know. I said, what can we do to make it swing and cook? He says, let me just forget the charts and let's just play like we're just playing. But it still had the Gil Evans stamp, but it was free and swinging, you know?
Yeah.
We eliminated the collar that was around the music. I did that on my Chubby Jackson big band day. I took little segments of the big band, and Chubby was very gracious to abandon the charts, and they were nice charts by Mulligan. We featured one track Mulligan, one track George Yule, Zoo, different things, and we made a night and used some of the charts, but it saved a whole session with great players, you know.
Yeah.
So that was my style.
So spontaneity was the really the chief goal there.
That's right. My underlying thing was it had to be happy. It had a cook and swing, and little by little, even with some of the modernists, it had to be funky too.
Yeah. You
know? So that was my goal, and I always try to get good musicians mixed in, like different type sessions. Like with Gene Ammons, I had him with Art Farmer, Donald Byrd, Eddie Suliman on different sessions, trumpets, Pepper Adams, Mal Waldron, Lou Donaldson. I try to have different variety of players from different schools, and they liked it. They inspired each other. I even had Bill Evans on a jam session, and I remember like it was yesterday. He was, I think it was Pepper Adams and Idris was there. He came over and he said, man, I enjoyed this, just to get out and cook, you know?
Yeah. Now, in some ways, this is your style, even though the style of music you were recording was classic kind of post Charlie Parker
right.
bop, but in some ways your style was similar to the one that Norman Granz had used.
That's
right,
right, exactly. What's your name?
Mike Jarrett.
Mike, that's a
yeah.
very good observation. People didn't understand what I was doing. They were too wrapped up. See, everybody thought of me, because I did Miles and Rollins and Train and Monk and Milk Jack, they thought I was a real modernist. But what they didn't understand is basically, I love modern jazz, you know, but I love the Norman Granz stuff too, and the swing era, and I even went back to King Oliver, Louis Armstrong, Jerry Will Morton, you know, and Bessie Smith, and then up from there to Billie Holiday, Fletcher Henderson, the Goodman Band of 38 with Krupa and Harry James. Man, I loved all of this shit. You know, Roy Eldridge to me was a giant.
Yeah.
You know, what was wrong with Dizzy playing with the Cab Calloway band?
Yeah.
You know? So I loved it all. It was good and it swung and had feeling. So they didn't understand. People to this day don't understand. So, oh, you recorded Getz and Miles and Train and Eric Dobbs and Monk. I said, yeah, but I also recorded Coleman Hawkins and Bud Freeman, Pee Wee Russell, Buck Clayton.
Yeah.
You know, and I also did, you know, funk, man. Now, 30 years later or more, they're catching up with the funk that I used to do. And Jimmy
right.
Smith on Blue Note.
Yeah.
You know, now England and Japan and Jack McDuff and Johnny Hammond Smith, they're up into that. Now, I just spoke to a tenor player on Sunday at Chubby Jackson's session. I'm thinking of recording him, trying to figure out what, you know. He's a very good player from Orlando. And I said, I'll say his name, Terry Myers, very good player.
Okay.
So, Terry, what can we do to make it interesting? Man, I want to play with an organ. Now, that's unheard of, man.
Yeah.
Back 30 years ago, a white tenor man sort of swinging in the Zoot Sims style never say I want to play with an organ.
Right.
You know, but that's what's happened. That the organ and the funk became a continuation of the mainstream.
Yeah.
You know, and the modern stuff sort of went off on another tangent, but the real mainstream of the jazz is the funk and hard swinging, you know.
Right. Well, one of the things you really took advantage of, you mentioned that briefly, was the LP, the invention of the LP.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the LP, now the CD. But look, let's face it, as a fan, one of my greatest experiences in life was I went to CBS Records one year, maybe in the 80s, because my ex-lawyer was the president, Dick Asher. And I used to run in there, and I knew Bob Altshuler, the press, the public relations head. So when I was in New York, I'd go and say hello to them. So I went in there one day to Bob Altshuler, and he says, Bob, John Hammond's on the phone. And I never met John Hammond, I knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Bob, give me that phone. And I got a, John, man, they've been reissuing all your shit, man. I got every Billie Holiday you did, the Benny Goodmans, the Sextets, and the Basies with Herschel and Lesnar. Man, you're too fucking much. You're the greatest, man. I love your records. I can't believe them. The stuff you did on Vanguard, I got all of them. And he says, wait a minute, man. He says, I got your Rollins and Coltrane and Miles Davis records. You've done some good too yourself.
Yeah.
And to me, that was a tribute. That was like the master, you know? And then you can go from him to Norman Granz. Man, Norman Granz, his stuff was so beautiful, you know? Norman Granz only knew one thing, swing and play pretty, two things.
Yeah.
I mean, the records he produced and the people that he saved their recording lives, man, by producing them right up to the end of their lives and putting them with Peterson and Ray Brown and Buddy Rich, Louis Belzer. He made such good records, you know. And then, he was my hero because one of the first things that really got me excited when I was in high school was his Jazz at the Philharmonic, you know, with Flip Phillips and Jacket.
Yeah.
And then let's talk about Alfred Lion. The man was a fucking genius because he went from New Orleans music and swing up to the latest modern things. He had stuff, you know, really.
Cecil Taylor.
Ornette Coleman. He was he was my real mentor.
But you recorded Dolphy before he did, right?
That's right, yeah. But the thing is, and I also recorded somebody called Gil Murray in the 50s, I think, who was just so contemporary, it was ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
He's done a lot of movie scores for big movies.
Okay.
He was a genius, but he was a very contemporary. But the thing is, I didn't copy Alfred because Alfred was very bebop-oriented, and Presti was very funky-oriented.
Right.
You know, there's overlaps. He had funk with Jimmy Smith. And
a little later on, yeah.
Yeah, and with you know, Turn Team, but I had Turn Team before, I think, with Shirley. But anyway, he always would say to me, his soul rest in peace, because he was a great man. He said, Bob Weinstock, he's going to follow me to the grave. And I say, no, Alfred, not me, baby. I'm going to be pissing on you. I kid him, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, no, you're going to follow me. I said, no, Alfred, I'm in better shape than you. I used to play semi-pro football, and I used to box. And I'm strong, like an animal, man. And I used to play hockey and everything. And I'm tough. Alfred, you're too dissipated. I would kid him.
Yeah.
You know, you smoke too much, you know.
Yeah.
And my philosophy, which Miles gave me, he says that Miles told me, and he never lived up to this, unfortunately. I was very close with Miles. He was a very bright man. And we'd always have these great intellectual discussions. And he came to me once and says, a man will live as long as he wants to. He made a statement. Miles would always say these weird things. You know?
Yeah.
So I said, well, Miles, what do you mean? He says, that's what I mean. You know, man is going to live as long as he wants to. I said, well, please tell me. It sounds good. You know?
Yeah.
He said, if a man takes care of himself, and his desire, and what he does, that he gets up in the morning basically healthy, and he wants to do things that he wants, he's going to live because he wants to live. And I believed him. I stopped smoking pot. I stopped drinking. I went back to the gym and started working out again.
Yeah.
It's not, and to this day, I'm 66 years old. You know, God has been good to me.
Yeah.
And I'm in better condition now than I've ever been because I don't do anything bad.
Yeah.
You know, I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't have salt. No
yeah.
Sugar. I don't have nicotine, no caffeine, because, man, I want to be around to keep doing this shit. I enjoy it.
Right, right. Which, as you said, Miles did not take his own advice.
No, and I believe, God willing, that I can be doing this shit another 20 years in good health.
Although Sonny Rollins took that advice.
Yeah,
Sonny cleaned up.
Sonny cleaned up. He's a smart guy, Sonny. He always was, Sonny.
Did he clean up while you were working with him, or was he?
I think so. It was very hard to tell.
Uh-huh.
Believe me. I forgot your name again.
Mike.
Mike. You know, it was very hard to tell because, see, a lot of these musicians, they get on and you never knew it.
Yeah, I mean, you really worked with some of the most famous of the people who were on, right?
I didn't know.
Yeah.
If you said to me, well, Miles is on.
Yeah.
I said, what? You know, they said, Train's on. Now, that's the last one I thought would ever be on.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know it, man.
Huh.
You never know.
Yeah.
You know, they say, well, this one's on, that one's on. But some, like Wardo Gray, if you told me that, I said, man, you're full of shit.
Yeah.
You know, I went out to Detroit and called Wardell right before he died. And, man, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know, and I wasn't around these people.
Now, what was your theory on how Wardell Gray died? Did you feel that it was pretty cut and dry, or do you feel that was a mysterious kind of death?
I really think, knowing Wardell, he wasn't the type of person who would offend anybody. Same like Stan Hasselgaard. Stan never recorded with me, but he was one of my greatest hanger-ons around the Prestige office. He was a young guy from Sweden, and he's a lovable, big, tall, blonde guy. He was a great clarinet player. Eventually, I would have recorded him, but the clarinet was sort of against the Mangiers,
right.
Outside Buddy DeFranco.
Buddy DeFranco, right.
Right. But eventually, I would record him, and he was like a great fan. He'd always be listening to records with me, and then just like Wardell, one day I heard he was dead, you
yeah.
know? And I don't know. All I can say is you get into the world, the bad world, let's call it the mean world.
Yeah.
The mean streets, all right? Say the mean streets.
Right.
Whether it be in the desert or in the ocean or on a boat or in the street or whatever, it's the mean streets, you know? And that's another world with its own rules.
Yeah.
And if you're going to play in the mean streets, anything can happen.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. Well, you avoided a lot of that, but for instance, Savoy was famous for having kind of mean streets connection.
Teddy Reig.
Teddy Reig?
Yeah, he was the head of all the recording.
Yeah.
He made great records, but the man was not a nice person. He pulled some shit on me right away. I was very successful right off the bat, and Symphony Sid, who was Teddy Reig's close friend, Symphony Sid used to play my records because I was making good records by people he loved, like Stan Getz, Kay Winding, J.J. Johnson, you know, Tristano Collins, Miles. So Sid was playing the shit out of my records, you know? And I didn't give him a nickel, you know, but he respected me because I made good jazz. He loved jazz, Sid. He had a lot of habits, a lot of faults, a lot of bullshit going around about him. But as far as I'm concerned, all he knew was I was a kid, you know, because I was very young,
mm-hmm.
and this kid makes good records. He'd tell everybody, and it burned Teddy Reig's ass, you know? So one day I'm going out under the Royal Roost, and a big black car comes in a Cadillac, and he says, Teddy Reig opens the door and says, get in, kid! So I wasn't afraid of anybody, man, because I box, I play football, you know? I don't give a shit, you know? And I was in the National Guard, I was in the military police at the time, you know, and they taught me, my hands were so quick that I could take a bayonet or a knife away from somebody before they even knew what I was doing. You know, I was trained for that shit.
Yeah.
So, and I play ping pong every day, which is the greatest game for reflex. You know,
uh-huh.
You know, play ping pong and you'll improve your reflexes. And I was a great athlete and I was strong. I still am, man, you know. I'm like a big middle linebacker or something, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, when I'm playing, I play for real. I don't fuck around. So he gets me in the car, and I'm not afraid of anything. He says, "You're fucking up the jazz business." I said, "What do you mean?" So he says, "You're paying these guys scale, and you're not doing exercise free like I am." So I said, "Well, why should I, man? The scale's cheap. It's cheap enough. I could do a whole floor size of a 78. I could do it for $300, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
What more do you want? Shit.
Yeah.
The guys are cooperating with me. They're doing it for scale. They like me. Why should I fuck them, man?" He said, "Yeah, but you're ruining the business." I said, "What business? Your business?"
Yeah.
I says, "Fuck you, open the door, let me out."
Uh-huh.
So he says, "Don't talk to me like that." He says, "You see who's up sitting, the two guys in the front?" I says, "Fuck you, fuck them, just open the door, man. If you want to fuck with me, you may beat me now, but you three will be dead tomorrow." You know, I knew the mafia game because my godfather was in Al Capone's gang in Chicago, and my father grew up with Rex Diamond, Dutch Schultz, Lepke, all those Jewish gangsters were my father's schoolmates. So I know he could beat me up today, man, but you'd be dead tomorrow.
Yeah.
I said, "That's it. Get open the fucking door, man." So he opens the door. And I said, "Listen, Teddy, I'm just doing it the right way. And believe me, from what I know, it's cheap enough, so I don't know why you got to fuck around, man. These are good people." You know? And he said, you know, yada, yada, bullshit.
Yeah.
So, but we became friends, you know, anyway, you know.
He
eventually
produced...
he stopped recording and went to work with Basie, you know.
Right. Well, he...